ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Welcome to the program and welcome to the future. Now, I say that because an Australian company has just been given approval to sell its lab-grown meat in Singapore, with hopes of having this product available to Aussie consumers soon.
Making anything that's being sold to vegans or vegetarians is a waste of time. Let them eat tofu. We want to be adding new offerings to the diet of people that already choose to eat meat and enjoy doing so.
Yep, today you'll get to learn about qualia, which according to the ad, is an entirely new animal made only to be delectable. And very soon on the Country Hour today, you'll get to find out who's been named the 2024 NT Rural Woman of the Year. A busy show today. Let's get amongst it. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, streaming online. And g'day to those who have tuned in via the podcast. As we go to air this afternoon, the Barkly Highway remains closed to vehicles over 4.5 tonnes. And for lighter vehicles, well, there's directional closures still in place. And this is all because of major flood damage to that highway, which, remember, is the only tarred road connecting Queensland to the Northern Territory. This afternoon, we have got Shane Tepper from Dipple on the program. The Department of Infrastructure is actually in Tennant Creek at the moment. He has been assessing the Barkly Highway. Shane, how's it looking?
Look, we do have quite a lot of damage to the Barkly Highway, particularly within the first sort of 80-kilometre section from the Stuart Highway. So a number of floodways, we've had some pavement damage and loss of seal. There's a number of large potholes and washouts to negotiate through some of those floodway areas. So we do have a number of sections that are down to single lane.
And the highway is still closed to heavy traffic, anything over 4.5 tonnes.
Yeah, look, that's correct. So it is only open to light vehicles only, so high clearance four-wheel drive under 4.5 tonnes. And we do have a directional road closure as well. So eastbound traffic are permitted to travel between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. and the westbound traffic are travelling between 12 p.m. and 3 p.m. That's between the section from Barkly Homestead to Stuart Highway.
During this period, which has been going for quite a few days now, I assume all of the heavy vehicles have been going up through the centre instead.
Yeah, look, I think they have been needed to take the long way around. So we are undertaking some assessments of the road this afternoon. So, look, we're hopeful that we may be able to open the Barkly Highway up to two trailer vehicles, so maximum 13 axles from tomorrow.
But, okay.
We'll just have to wait and see from the assessments. We'll be updating the NT Road Report with any changes to those conditions.
And the directional flow, traffic only allowed to go one way at certain times of the day, how long are you expecting that to stay in place for?
Look, at this stage, you know, we still do have a number of big potholes and washouts that, you know, are particularly difficult to navigate at night time, as well as, you know, there is a need for sort of single lane through some of those sections. So, look, I would anticipate it's into next week that we'll have to maintain those directional closures.
Yep.
We are actually looking at potentially revising the timing around those closures. So we'd be providing some advance notice of that on the NT Road Report if there are any changes made to those times next week.
Has it been working okay, this directional flow?
Yeah, we've been getting good compliance. We've had the occasional vehicle that's gone up the wrong direction at the wrong time, but generally we've been able to turn them back fairly quickly.
Okay. How would you summarise the damage? I mean, is it the worst you've ever seen it?
For the Barkly Highway, particularly that section of the Barkly Highway west of the Barkly Homestead, it's probably the worst damage I've seen. Yeah, look, you know, we do get flood damage and road closures most wet seasons, but look, this would be one of the biggest seasons I've seen for damage across most of our national highways.
And is there water still over parts of the Barkly?
Yeah, there is. So the waters have sort of receded a lot in the last few days, but there is sort of, you know, up to 20 centimetres of water over some parts of the Barkly Highway, particularly in that first 80-kilometre section.
How big is the job to fix it up?
Look, it'll be very substantial. So, look, at the moment we're just focusing on the remedial repairs to get the road open to traffic again, and you sort of get the freight and the public moving. But, you know, it'll be an ongoing task over the next several months for the restoration. So we're going to have to rehabilitate a number of sections of pavement as well as add some additional protection works to the shoulders.
And when you go to rebuild the Barkly, already do you have some thoughts in mind on how to perhaps do it differently?
Yeah, look, I think we do need to look at alternatives. We've had some sections that have washed away sort of, you know, multiple times in recent years. So, yeah, we do look at alternative treatments and additional protection works to make the road more resilient.
Anything else you'd like our audience to know about this afternoon, Shane?
It's just that there will be, you know, a lot of road construction crews and maintenance crews out on the roads and traffic management in place. So certainly drivers need to slow down through those areas of floodways where there is roadworks. And particularly those areas where we do have water over the road, there's need to be mindful of the potholes and washouts that might be underneath that water. Generally the biggest ones we've got signposted with hazard warning signs. So just be careful when you're driving through those areas.
And we'll keep an ear out for potentially some changes around the heavy vehicles perhaps being allowed onto that highway tomorrow.
Yeah. Look, as soon as that's confirmed, we'd be posting that to the NT Road Report website. So just keep an eye on that for any updates.
Great. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks very much.
Cheers. Shane Tepper, he's the Project Director of Civil Asset Management with the Department of Infrastructure, the Barkly Highway. Badly damaged. Worst damage that Shane has seen on that stretch of highway. And just repeating, as we go to air this afternoon, the highway is still closed to vehicles over 4.5 tonnes between Threeways and the Barkly Homestead. And as for lighter vehicles, well, this is information that you need to be aware of. If you're heading eastbound, you can only do so between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. If you're heading westbound, you can only do so between midday and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There could be some changes to this as of tomorrow. Stay up to date via the Road Report NT website and, of course, the ABC, your emergency broadcaster. It is 23 to 1. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, you'll find out who's been named the Territory's 2024 Rural Woman of the Year.
Hi, I'm Sophie. I work at Monsoon Aquatics and I love working with giant clams. You're listening to Country Hour.
It is a Thursday lunchtime, and I trust you are well. The winner of the 2024 AgriFutures NT Rural Women's Award was announced last night at Parliament House at a wonderful gala event. Who won the award? Well, I'll let the Chief Minister of the Territory tell you.
2024
Edgerton
Rural Women's Award winner is Tanya Edgerton.
Yes, well done to Tanya Edgerton and her remote op shop project. This project, it supplies recycled clothes to remote Indigenous communities while also creating work opportunities. Tanya's acceptance speech last night. Wow, it was wonderful. At times it was teary. It was extremely motivating. Here's just a moment of her speech last night where she talks about the opportunities now to expand this project.
With over 1,000 First Nations communities across remote Australia, there's still a lot more that we can do. And so to scale beyond this point, we are engaging the fashion and textile industry as part of the solution. Australia is the world's second largest consumer of textiles and responsible for over 200,000 tonnes of clothing going to landfill every year. This is not charity. This is a business proposition that turns their excess into opportunity, centred around a network of textile reuse and recycling hubs in Northern Australia. The hubs will collect and sort high-value items and distribute them back out to a network of remote communities, minimising waste and maximising social good. With this additional support from AgriFutures, Westpac and the Northern Territory Government, we are poised to scale this impact further, and the funds from this award enable us to officially form our First Nations Leadership Council to ensure the Remote Op Shop project remains grounded and driven by the communities it serves. It is my ask that you join us in creating a new story, one where First Nations peoples in remote Australia transition from intergenerational inequity to intergenerational opportunity. Thank you again to everybody involved.
Yeah, Tanya Edgerton, winner of the 2024 AgriFutures NT Rural Women's Award for her remote op shop project. What did she say? Turning excess into opportunity. Now, Tanya now receives a $15,000 grant to further support her project and will go on to represent the Northern Territory at the National Awards in Canberra later on this year. On the Country Hour this week, we've been featuring all four nominees for this award. Tanya was on the show yesterday, and later on today you'll be hearing from Rebecca Forrest, who's actually in Katherine today hosting the inaugural Katherine Youth Conference. Her project is called Youth on Boards. You'll hear all about that later on the Country Hour. It is 19 to 1. We're going to have a quick tune here by Midnight Oil. And then up next, we'll be talking about the rehabilitation of the Ranger uranium mine. A big job, an expensive job, and it sounds like ERA has gone to mum and dad for help.
Hi, I'm Nicola Hanrahan. I live in Darwin and I'm a researcher at CDU. I listen to the Country Hour on my way to work.
That's the way to do it. Matt Brown with you this afternoon. A moment ago, we were talking about the Barkly Highway with Shane Tepper from the Department of Infrastructure. He and his team have been out there assessing that highway. He told us that the damage to that highway between Threeways and the Barkly Homestead is some of the worst he's ever seen.
Look, we do have quite a lot of damage to the Barkly Highway, particularly within the first sort of 80-kilometre section from the Stuart Highway. So a number of the floodways, we've had some pavement damage and loss of seal. There's a number of large potholes and washouts to negotiate through some of those floodway areas. So we do have a number of sections that are down to single lane.
That is Shane Tepper speaking to us a moment ago. We're joined now by Louise Bilardo from the NT Road Transport Association. Afternoon to you, Louise. Sounds like the Barkly Highway has seen better days.
Yeah, good afternoon, Matt. Well, it's had a lot of rain too, hasn't it?
Yeah, this damage, what does it mean for your members?
Well, we were happy to support the department to close the highway to heavy vehicles for a week from last week before Easter, or Saturday morning actually, it stopped for our heavy vehicles to allow that roadworks repairs to be undertaken, and understanding how difficult it is when you've got heavy vehicles as well as light vehicles on single lanes to actually be safely repaired. But we understand with the opening tomorrow that there is still more work to be done, but we're very much needing the department to consider triple road trains rather than doubles. And we've put that argument back to DIPL just a little while ago to request that they consider putting some very significant speed restrictions from the Barkly Homestead to the Threeways, but to allow triple road trains to traverse that section of damaged road.
Right, because yes, Shane mentioned that potentially tomorrow it opens up to doubles. You're arguing for triple road trains to be allowed. If triples go on that road tomorrow, is there a risk of the road being damaged further?
No, it's not the damage to the road. It's the risk of a trailer rolling when it is down to single lane and at some sections. So the 50 to 60 kilometres east of the freeways on the Barkly Homestead on the Barkly Highway is pretty severely degraded, as he said. Mm. There's two other sections at the 32 kilometre from the Stuart Highway turnoff, as well as the 2 to 5 kilometres straight up, or 5 to 7 kilometres straight after the Stuart Highway turnoff. But we would prefer that there's triples allowing those, especially the line haul operators and the cattle carters, to come through, because dropping trailers, shuttling trailers, comes with a lot more prime mover movements, and it also comes with its own risks when you've got trailers being dropped and then having to be reconfigured, etc. There's always risks associated with doing that. The other complicating factor for all our line haul operators is that they generally are two up, and they have, you know, fatigue, risk management, compliance obligations.
Yep.
Under the NHVR rules, which are challenging when you're doing the one-way traffic as it is, and then to have to be delaying and then going back and picking up that third trailer, or one of the operators having to do that without having trucks stationed either at the freeways or at the Barkly, is complicated. So
I guess I just assumed that a lot of these companies would be taking the long way around during this period. Has there been a bit of that happening?
Yeah, they had to do that last week. And the long way around from Brisbane is an extra 4,700 kilometres.
4,700 kilometres extra to the trip.
Yes, and that... Wow. Well, and part of the reason, Matt, why we did urge the road to be closed to heavy vehicles last week was to allow those transport operators to negotiate with their customers, because the 4,700 kilometres additional travel is very, very expensive. Whereas if the road was open to singles, as was suggested, that cost is imposed on the transport operator to do three trips across the Barkly instead of one carrying three trailers. So it gets very expensive. It is complicated. But we also think that with the speed limit restriction, so if it's 80 kilometres across the Barkly and 40 kilometres an hour, where the really seriously degraded sections that Shane was referring to are, then that applies to everyone, light vehicles, heavy vehicles, the lot. But if that's imposed strictly, we think that those triple road trains can very safely travel across the degraded sections without impacting the pavement, because it's not the third trailer that impacts the pavement. Mm. The pavement damage is already there. It's it's the increased prime mover movements that has an effect on wear and tear. But all of those vehicles, if they're all correctly laden, which the food trucks certainly are, won't be imposing more damage. It's just the risk of a trailer dropping when you've got them manoeuvring between left and right sides of the single lane bitumen.
Yes. A couple of things, Louise Bellato, and we really appreciate your time here. When this highway is getting repaired, rebuilt, do you have a wish list on what you'd love to see done to that highway?
The Barkly's a tough one, because everyone knows that it's built on black soil. I think in terms of the road engineering now, there'd probably be a lot more culverts put into sections of floodways that previously in, years gone by, we're very familiar with the Barkly, but that's probably where there would be need for a lot more, re-engineering. But it was a substantial wet season. So all the oldies have told me that the last good wet of this magnitude on the Barkly was 2001 and 25 years before that. So, again, it's not every day, but it's taken a hell of a lot of rain, and it's caused a lot of washouts and potholes. And commend the civil contractors who are doing the work to do the repairs at the moment. But we would definitely request that DIPL consider the bigger picture here with those transporters that are really trying to do the job very efficiently to save them the 4,700 kilometres long way round, and doing the doubles and then single shuffle.
And our last question is from the audience, and it's a doozy. This is in regards to the directional closures. The question is, Matt, after living on the Barkly for many years, I find it odd that they have the traffic travelling into the sun in the morning and then into the sun again in the afternoon.
Yes, so DIPL are already onto that, and were requesting to change that around, and also to support the station owners who need to go into Tennant Creek to get supplies that could do within a day if the 6 to 9 a.m. was from east to west, which we've supported. The only challenge to that has been from some of the cattle carters moving livestock into the port for a boat loadout next week that have got livestock in Cloncurry. So those trucks would have to have animals on the truck for, you know, 8 to 10 hours longer, because they can't spell them at the Barkly Homestead if they load them in Cloncurry in the morning.
So the cattle industry has perhaps influenced those times.
No, they haven't. It just hasn't. Well, again, the big loadout hopefully would only be for a few days, so it might be, it might be able to be accommodated. I don't know, but it was just, implemented, but certainly DIPL are very aware of the sun and the need to reduce the glare on all road users as much as possible. And it's neither here nor there for the line haul freight carters. They come out and they'll sort themselves out, but for the cattle, it sounded like it was a bit of a tricky one.
Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
No worries, Matt. Thank you.
That is Louise Bilotto from NT Road Transport Association. It's 4 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's turn our attention now to some resources news. The job of rehabilitating the Ranger uranium mine looks like it's been handballed to Rio Tinto. Dan Fitzgerald, what can you tell us?
Well, ERA, so is Energy Resources Australia, the company that has been running the mine for years and has been responsible for its cleanup. Its independent board members approached Rio Tinto, which is the major shareholder in ERA.
Parent company.
Owns 83% of the shares. The independent directors of the board approached Rio with this proposal to hand over management of the rehabilitation of Ranger. Rio has agreed to manage all aspects of the cleanup in accordance with plans and budgets approved by the ERA board. ERA Chair Brad Welsh said in a statement, "The ERA team has worked incredibly hard and made good progress rehabilitating Ranger. However, as the project moves into a new phase, it will benefit from Rio Tinto's global expertise in mine closure." Now, the question of funding for the remainder of the rehab, that's still a bit up in the air. Rio Tinto has agreed to provide its services at cost price, and Rio will stump up for some of the services. The total cost of the cleanup is,
it's a lot of money,
believed to be more than $2.4 billion, and it won't be finished until well after 2028. The traditional owners of the Ranger country, where the Ranger mine is, are represented by the Gunjakmi Aboriginal Corporation. Its chief executive, Talia van den Bogaard, says the TOs have welcomed this handover to Rio Tinto.
The Mirror, I think this is a step in the right direction. Rio has more expertise and experience, but it's still unclear where the funds will actually come from, especially seeing that it is rehabilitation on such a large scale that has never been done before, and that it is in the World Heritage List at National Park.
The project has been hampered by serious issues with funding. So does this mean, as far as you understand it, that Rio will stump up the billions of dollars needed to do this project? I mean, what do they stand to gain out of that?
I'm not sure. Like I said, we are not completely sure yet where the funding is coming from. Rio is more financially stable than ERA is. They're in a lot of financial trouble. So we're more confident that this will complete the rehabilitation, but it's never been done before. So it remains to be seen how it will be finished.
Talia van den Bogaard, she's the CEO of the Gonjatmi Aboriginal Corporation, speaking there earlier with Adam Steer. So, yeah, Rio Tinto taking over the rehabilitation of the Ranger mine. That handover process will take a few months and will be sort of complete in the second half of this year.
All right. Thank you for keeping us up to date, Dan Fitzgerald. Have you seen the pictures of the qualia? A new animal designed only to be delectable.
I was surprised by how blue it was.
I was surprised at how blue it was. Get out the knife and fork and we'll tuck into one in the second half of the Country Hour. But now let's go to the newsroom. 1 o'clock.
G'day, my name is Floyd. Yeah, I work in the Spanish mackerel fishery in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I love what I do and love my job, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon, and the future is here. An Australian company has just been given approval to sell its lab-grown meat in Singapore, with hopes of having this product available to Aussie consumers very, very soon. How do you feel about hooking into a good feed of qualia? What is qualia? I'll just play some of the advertisement music, just to get you in the mood for this. Yeah, that's the sort of drama I'm after when it comes to lab-grown meat. How does this sound? Most high-end diners want something no one has ever tried before, driving a pursuit that has pushed food to new frontiers. What if we went further and cultured cells to create a new animal made only to be delicious? Introducing qualia. Taste it today. This is not April's Fool stuff, as someone texted in. No, it's not an April Fool's late joke. This is happening. The boss of Vow will be on the Country Hour in just a moment. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is there this afternoon. Billy, that southeasterly surge, where's it and what's it doing?
Yeah, look, it's over the northern Barkly at the moment and moving northwards. So, yeah, Tennant Creek's pretty dry. Blowing around 30 k's per hour, gusting stronger than that through the Barkly. Elsewhere to the north, the dry is, I guess, just slowly trickling in. So, yeah, look, in the top end, it's not going to come through as a real classic southeasterly surge. It's going to be a bit of a trickle day in, day out, but it's definitely slowly starting to dry out across the north, and as a result, we're seeing that the rain become a lot more isolated and contracting north as well. So expecting just the chance of some afternoon showers north of about Daly Waters today, but it's really around the northern top end that is probably most likely to see any rain.
And all of a sudden, the daily rainfall bulletin is looking fairly light on compared to the last few weeks. There is a marine wind warning in place for the Beagle Bonaparte coast. The tropical weather, where's it at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is classic April weather. On one hand, we're talking about, you know, the dry season coming in, and then on the other hand, there's still the risk of tropical lows and cyclones forming. So we're currently saying that there's a high risk of a cyclone forming off the WA coastline over the weekend. There's a low at the moment starting to form to the west of Timor around Indonesia. So rainfall picking up that way. This system poses no risk or impact for the Northern Territory. High risk of a cyclone around the Australian waters over the weekend, and then sort of the second half of next week or middle of next week, we may see a trough or a low develop around the top end as well. So, that transition month.
There's still some life in the wet season. The potential for a cyclone off that WA coast Could it deliver moisture into central Australia, potentially?
No, that's not. I'm not seeing anything like that with this system. It's barely going to bring any rainfall to the coastal parts of WA. It's just probably going to, move southwest and sort of stay away from the coastline.
Oh, right. Because cattle stations south of Broome are desperate for a drop. So they might get teased by this. And
yeah, I wouldn't get your hopes up with this system. Yeah.
Anything else we need to be aware of this afternoon?
Not really, no. It's a bit hard to elaborate too much on a much simpler weather pattern right now. So that's about all I got. Sorry, Matt.
Walking up Mitchell Street this morning, the dragonflies were out. I know that, that theory's been debunked a long time ago, but it was noticeable. They were around. Just finally, we're speaking to you on the phone, Billy Lynch. It's moving day at the Weather Bureau. What can you tell us?
It is moving day, yeah. It's our last day in our Casuarina office today. So I'm sitting in an office surrounded by boxes and, it looks like any typical house when you're moving.
Yeah.
Come next week, we'll be in our new premises, which... we've been in this office. We moved from the city to Casuarina in the mid-90s. So we've been here quite a while, and the building's starting to get quite old now. And anyway, my organisation wants to move us back into the city now, so that's what we're doing.
You're coming back to town. Yeah, okay. Yep. Well, all the best with the moving. Be careful with the breakables, and we'll see you around town.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you. That's Billy Lynch there at the Weather Bureau. It is 11 past one. Let's talk about lab-grown meat. Because the lab-grown meat company Vow has become the first Australian company to receive approval to sell this type of protein to consumers. Vow has received approval from the Singaporean Food Agency to sell its lab-grown quail meat. And it's hoping to receive similar approval to start selling this product to Aussie consumers. Angus Verley has spoken just a short time ago to Vow's chief executive, George Pepu.
Today we announced that Vow is officially approved and on sale in Singapore with our very first product, which is a cultured Japanese quail. So made from cultured animal cells, which were originally derived from a Japanese quail, and now available in some of the best venues across Singapore.
Why Singapore?
We've been working with regulators across a bunch of different markets, including Australia and Singapore. And Singapore was the first market which we reached approval. It's also a really good market to launch a luxury product like we're producing in, under our brand, our sort of premium brand Forged. It's a very, very high-end dining scene here with a really wide variety of different cuisines from all over the world. And frankly, some of the best chefs in the world choose to open restaurants in Singapore. You've got a really adventurous local foodie group, sort of foodie population, alongside a lot of travelers coming from all over the world. So it's a really good place to introduce something really new and distinctive like what we're producing.
So a high-end product, what sort of price are we talking?
I'd say think of it as a amongst the highest price point of any kind of animal protein you'd find. I can't share the exact numbers as it's a little bit commercially sensitive, but it would be amongst the most expensive proteins you'd find anywhere from any kind of distributor in Singapore.
And is that going to be your approach as you develop other products, or will you be looking to go across different price points?
Definitely go across different price points, but our whole strategy as a business is has always been to say, hey, farmers are really good at producing the meat we know today. There's no point trying to replicate beef, chicken, or pork. It's a fool's errand. I love eating meat myself, and there's no way that I'm going to be tricked, let alone we're going to trick anyone else into thinking they're eating a new version of the same thing. So instead, let's use this new technology to offer something which is distinctive from what we already consume. And we're starting off by introducing that into these really high-end venues based on the novelty and distinctiveness that we've been able to create. because we have access to this new sort of toolkit of cultured meat. But then as we sort of move down market, as our scale increases and our cost structure improves, we're looking at the areas like improved nutrition. So for groups which have particularly high nutritional needs, whether that's particular nutrients you'd otherwise find in meat, or certain protein goals or requirements, or wanting more nutrient density and a smaller serve size, serving some of those niche markets at a lower price point. And then hopefully one day, being able to offer some of these really distinctive offerings at a supermarket level, but sold purely as brands in the same way you might buy a breakfast cereal, not sold as animals.
So you're marketing to meat eaters, people who love meat but are looking to try something new or different?
Exactly, exactly. There's a massive growing global demand in meat consumption, and making anything, if that's a problem you want to sort of contribute to, making anything that's being sold to vegans or vegetarians is a waste of time. Let them eat tofu. We want to be adding new offerings to the diet of people that already choose to eat meat and enjoy doing so.
Are your products actually meat?
I mean, you can have a look at what Food Standards ANZ said on this. It kind of doesn't matter from my point of view. As long as we're serving them on the same plate or in sort of a similar occasion where people would otherwise eat meat. There's been a lot of arguments all around the world of whether cultured meat products are or aren't meat. But to me, that misses the point. Why we've started now, why we've built this company to this point, is to offer new and distinctive experiences and new and distinctive foods that are different from what animals can produce. And so whether we call it meat or not, it's actually kind of immaterial, because we want people to be just adding this to their diets in similar occasions, regardless of what it's called.
You don't need to go into the technicalities, but can you just give a basic overview of how these products are actually produced?
Absolutely. So we start with a small sample from basically any animal. In the case of this first Singapore approval, it's a small sample of quail. We then go through a process to select for the cells that would repair the tissues that you find in meat, so muscle, fat, and connective tissue. We take those cells and we place them in an environment and feed them everything they get otherwise. So sugars, salts, amino acids, vitamins and minerals, and a few other bits and pieces. And then we place all of that, so that nutritional liquid and the cells, into a very, very clean stainless steel tank where we basically let them grow. And then we separate out the cells, add a few bits and pieces, in the case of the parfait, a bit of butter, garlic, thyme, brandy and cognac, and then package it up and send it off.
What's your output, your volume of production at the moment?
Right now, out of our current facility, 100 kilos in a good month. So we're at a relatively small scale. We have a much larger facility we're working on at the moment, but even still, is even in our most aggressive, most optimistic timelines, we're going to be the size of a large farm in a couple of years. It's like, in terms of output, there's a long way for us to go.
So you've got approval in Singapore. You're also seeking approval to sell in the Australian market?
That's correct, yes.
And where is that process at?
So in Australia, we've gone through the first public consultation period earlier this year. There's a second public consultation period that the food regulator is opening up in the coming weeks around the sort of final wording that they're intending to use in amending the Food Act. And then the timeline will be updated on their website when they have a new estimate. The last estimate was towards the end of this year for them wrapping up that assessment.
And what's your view on the future if we were to, say, fast forward 10 years? What sort of market share do you think these products could have?
As someone that loves eating meat, I think if we look forward 10 years, there's going to be a few different products which are going to be consumed by some groups of consumers on occasion. So I think we'll be seeing some consumers which are really trying to optimize their nutrition, eating cultured meat a day or two a week, as well as you'll see it on the menu of a lot of high-end restaurants. But knowing how long it takes to scale up and how much capital is required, it's not going to be something which is going to be taking up much space in the supermarket in the next 10 years.
And you mentioned nutrition. Some criticisms of various meat alternatives are both taste or lack thereof and also a lack of nutrition. But how would you say you think your products stack up?
So our first, everything we're producing at the moment, we're really focused purely on sensory experience. And so while the nutrition is comparable to the meat, to what you'd find in conventional meat in terms of both its macro and micronutrient profile, our next generation and a lot of the work we're doing at the moment is how do we tweak that? So if we do want to increase the availability of some vitamins, how do we increase that set of vitamins?
That is the Chief Executive of Vow, George Pepu, speaking to Angus Verley. This company has been given approval to start selling this lab-grown quail meat in Singapore. Could be coming to a dinner plate near you if all goes to plan for this company. Qualia. I've seen the advertisement for it, and it's intriguing. It really is. I think I might put it on Landline this Sunday.
This week on Landline, authorities look for the cause of death of more than 100 cattle on board a live export ship bound for Indonesia. And great debate over the controversial proposal to inject liquefied CO2 emissions deep underground.
CO2 in the Great Artesian Basin just doesn't belong there. It's going to wreak havoc.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
On the text line 0487991057, Sprinkles says, Matt, Billy Lynch reckons 30-kilometre southeasterly winds across the Barkley. That's going to have the trucks chewing through heaps more fuel, plus being blown around, says Sprinkles. And I've been sent here a picture from Jimmy of the red centre looking extremely green. And Jimmy says this photo conjures up thousands of words such as dust suppression, soil and moisture retention, palatable, photosynthesizing like it's going out of fashion, reliable and marvelous. You bet it's bufflegrass, says Jimmy in the Emerald City. It's 20 past one. Up next, you'll meet one of the wonderful nominees in this year's NT Rural Women's Award.
Six decks bound for Darwin, be part of the territory.
Six decks to Darwin, as long as you're not doing it on the Barkley, the Carpentaria, the Tablelands, the Central Arnhem, the list goes on at this time of the year. It's 24 past one. This week, we've been catching up with all of the nominees for this year's NT Rural Women's Award. Yesterday, you heard from Tenya Edgington and her fantastic project called The Remote Op Shop, which, as you've heard, actually won last night's award. But all four nominees are just amazing. And so today, I want you to meet Rebecca Forrest, who is the founder of No One Left Behind. She's very busy in Catherine today. I spoke to her earlier about her new project, which is called Youth on Boards.
Well, the Youth on Boards project is really an evolution of the free youth conferences we've been running around the territory for the last few years. What it is just trying to find those formalised pathways to encourage young people to join boards, committees, sporting clubs, but also training the oldies in those boards, committees and sporting clubs on how they can better engage with young people, how they can attract, but most importantly, retain them in their organisation.
That's important, isn't it? Because I think of my own experience when I was in my 20s. I got involved in some community groups. I found it really daunting.
Look, it really is. Yeah, I completely agree. But the thing is that it's often those stepping stones and those pathways. You know, when we encourage a young person to get on stage as a panelist, funnily enough, the following year, you know, when we're doing the youth conferences again, they put their hand up to be the facilitator. Next thing, they're applying to be a Youth Week ambassador and then, you know, Youth Roundtable rep. So we are seeing that these pathways work. So what we're trying to develop with this Youth on Boards project is a digital toolkit where we can encourage and nurture young people into organisations, because it's like getting them job ready. This is a stepping stone for that career. And I think we've shown that we really need to engage young people in the workforce. You know, nationally, that is certainly a conversation that we're having. And this is a really wonderful way that we can kind of bridge that communication barrier that is also happening between young people and older generations.
And what have the results been like thus far?
Well, we've already connected with hundreds of service providers through the youth conferences. And what's been incredible about that is it's one of the only opportunities where it's a one-stop shop. We're not just here doing, you know, Careers Expo. We're not just here talking health and well-being. We're all encompassing. So we've already made these connections and we're already seeing young people better engage with these service providers. And so it makes perfect sense that we take the next step and have them embed in all of these organisations as well, be it in a voluntary role, in a support role, on a committee, on a board. So it really is just trying to formalise that process so young people are more engaged in our community initiatives.
Now, I am speaking to you while you're in Katherine, getting ready to set up the inaugural Katherine Youth Conference. Tell us about that. Yeah.
Look, it's quite incredible. And the beauty of the youth conferences is I'm like the only old bag involved. It's all youth led. So every single person on the stage, the panelists, the speakers, the band's actually doing a sound check right behind me now. You know, they're all young people and they lead this. You know, when people come to me and go, oh, Beck, what themes do you want us to talk about? I'm like, no, this is youth led. What do you want to talk about? And we need to be really authentic in that approach. So the beauty of this is I'm actually not really the one involved doing this. I'm on the side encouraging and supporting young people. And when you allow it, just give them the stage, build a platform, and then get out of the way. You see magic happen.
You do a lot in the Northern Territory, Rebecca. What does it mean to you to be nominated for the Rural Women's Award?
Look, I'm incredibly honoured. What I really love about this award is that it's project-based. You know, all of the finalists have the most incredible projects. We're all there trying to improve our community. So it's not about accepting an award. It's actually about investing in our community, in our future, and driving these projects home. So I'm absolutely honoured, and it would be a pleasure to be rolling out the Youth on Boards project as part of the AgriFuture Rural Women's Awards.
All the best in Katherine with the Youth Conference, and thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thanks so much. You can't go wrong when you let Youth Voice have it.
That is Rebecca Forrest, the founder of No One Left Behind. She was also the 2022 winner of the NT Australian of the Year Local Hero Award. And that inaugural Katherine Youth Conference, it's happening right now in K-Town at the local Arts Centre. So I hope that event is going well. And well done again to Tanya Edgington, who last night at Parliament House was named the NT's Rural Woman of the Year. Just quickly, big news in the red meat sector. Meat and Livestock Australia has announced that Michael Crowley will be its next managing director. Jason Strong is gone. Michael Crowley is the new MD. He's most recently been the chief executive at Herefords Australia and prior to that held several senior roles with MLA. MLA's chair, Alan Beckett, says Mr. Crowley would be leading the development of a new 5-year strategic plan for the organisation, and he'll be starting work on the 27th. Of May. So well done to Michael Crowley. Looking forward to hearing him soon here on the Country Hour. We'll be talking about ladybugs on the program tomorrow. Keep it rural.